This is Radio Free Aslan, broadcasting from occupied territory. Hello, everyone. My name is Ernesto Todd Morales, and this is yet another Chicano Development Center podcast. Today, we are talking with Professor Dylan Miner of the Residential College of Arts and Humanities at Michigan State University. Dylan is a member of the Just Seeds Art Collective and a printmaker. We're going to be talking today about Chicano art and art for art's sake. But first, Dylan, tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you're doing here in the Lansing community.
All right, thanks for having me out. Like Todd said, my name is Dylan Miner, and I am both trained as an art historian and an artist. And in terms of my intellectual interests, I'm interested in thinking about the function of art within social movements, and that's primarily within the Chicano movement, within the Movimiento, and within American Indian and anti-colonial movements here in North America and in Latin America. In terms of what I do as an artist, I am working mostly as a printmaker. I am a member of Just Seeds, and hopefully some of you listening to this podcast are familiar with Just Seeds. And if not, check out the website justseeds.org. We're a collective of over 20 members located throughout North America. We have members in Canada, the United States, and in Mexico. There's three of us in Mexico City, one in Montreal, and kind of in urban spaces is throughout North America. And what we do, Just Seeds, is this worker-owned collective of anti-authoritarian and activist artists who are making work in tandem with social justice organizations. And we can talk a little bit about that later, I think, in the podcast. In my own work, and you can scope my work on my website, dylanminer.com, and hopefully there'll be a link from the Development Center's website. I think there already is, actually. But one of the things that I'm interested in terms of my own art is that we seem to be living in a world of never-ending late capitalist consumption. And the more we consume, the more we make. And as part of this consumption, we're always buying mass-produced, highly designed, highly slick objects that you can't even tell were made by a human hand. And so in my own work, I'm interested in making work that looks like someone made it, with all of its kind of grossities and all of its errors and all of its failures and all of that kind of in the object. And so I primarily make relief prints on paper bags, primarily mostly in two colors, in red and black, which connects to a particular labor history, of course. And the images I make tell stories of marginalized and oppressed and forgotten peoples, working class stories, indigenous stories, Chicano and Latino stories, and bring them into spaces that otherwise wouldn't see these. I just did an installation for those of you in Michigan. It was at Saginaw Valley State University. And one of the things I did was I did an installation and incorporated an ice fishing shanty and a deer hunting blind, because these are the daily objects a lot of us are familiar with. And so it's about reclaiming spaces that where we tell our histories and spaces where we can reclaim as radical, right? What if we took over the ice fishing shanty as a site of kind of activist learning? And what if we took over the deer blind and the activities that go on there as a kind of a radical re-education space? And to me, I think that's what they are. So I see my work as kind of operating within this, as an educational and pedagogical tool, but one of reclaiming histories that are important to me and histories that are important to our communities, but oftentimes aren't told.
Okay. All right. Well, that's really interesting. This whole idea of, I think one of the last things that you said, though, talking about the ice fishing shanties and the deer blinds as spaces of radical, re-education. Right. I mean, maybe you could, elaborate on that a little bit. I mean, growing up here in Michigan, I mean, obviously those are things that I've seen before, but also too growing up in the city. And I think that lots of times, we have this idea that activism is something that happens in urban areas, and that it in the rural areas that people are very conservative and that they're very
pro-United States and that they don't engage in this sort of like activism or even this sort of like reimagining of, you know, of spaces that they see on a regular basis. I mean, how did you kind of come to that?
Right, right. Well, I mean, if you know me, I was born and raised in rural Michigan. And as much as I wanted to escape both Michigan and the country, I think that instilled within me a certain kind of a way of seeing the world. And there is in rural spaces a certain form of radicalism that we don't oftentimes think about. And there are things that happen that we don't think about and we don't see. I'm Métis, which is a person of mixed First Nations or Aboriginal and European descent. And the Métis were often called by our Cree cousins the Otepemi Siwak, which translates as the people without bosses. And so there's this legacy, I think, particularly within communities of color living in rural areas of a very grassroots kind of radical history going on there. And you know, I think it's, you know, I mean, when we think of ice fishing shanties and deer blinds, I think you're right. These aren't thought of as places that traditionally are seen as very radical and progressive and spaces that we can reclaim. But I think we need to think of them about them that way. I know that myself, I'm interested in alternative pedagogies, alternative ways of teaching, and alternative ways of learning, right? And why is it that we write off possibly rural sectors? Why is it that we write off places like the deer fishing blind or the ice fishing shanty and these things, places that we go, the rural setting? Why do we write these off? And if those of us in urban areas do write them off, then I think they are going to be lost. But we can reclaim them. And I think the tradition of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, the Wobblies, if we look at where they were organizing kind of unskilled laborers in rural areas. They were organizing miners. I mean, we think of the Western Federation of Miners, which was a radical kind of mining union that was in many ways tied to the IWW, but they were mining in rural, or they were organizing in rural mining communities, and we see the same. I think farm worker organizing is very similar. That the rural settings don't have to be thought of as some kind of intellectual and radical backwater, but we need to reclaim those and make sure we don't let those kind of slip away.
Okay.
All right. Okay. So you talked a little bit about the IWW, and I know that you have a lot of interest in that. I mean, in having seen some of your prints, you know, I can see that your own way of looking at art is very strong with like labor history and the labor movement and really trying to promote the solidarity of people. But you also had the opportunity to work with a very famous printmaker who lived in Chicago for many years before he passed away, Carlos Cortez, who is also or was also a member of the IWW, and he happened to do prints right. Very similar to you. So, I mean, maybe you could tell us a little bit about working with Carlos Cortez.
Right. Well, I mean, I think if you go to Chicago, particularly where Carlos lived his adult life, I think you'll find a lot of people who have been inspired both by Carlos's art, but as him as a person. And myself, I think of Carlos as a mentor and as one of the people who really inspired me to do what I'm doing now. And I met him a handful of times. I was probably around 20 when I went to Chicago and got in contact with him and began having conversations with him and brought him up to, at that time I was living in Kalamazoo and brought him up to Kalamazoo. And that was a really kind of changing moment in the way that I saw my artwork, and for me, I was trying to. When I finished high school, I went to an art school and kind of began to study design, because that's what I was told you could do if you had any sort of artistic talent. You went and you made these. You kind of became a corporate whore, and I did that for a minute. I went to art school for a year studying design, and then was doing a. Doing in the mid '90s some web design for large automotive corporations, and that's what I thought you were supposed to do, and I felt very, very kind of empty from doing these sorts of activities, and so when I met Carlos and realized that I wasn't the only one who was interested in making art, that was true to my own political and intellectual and kind of social commitments, I realized that you could continue to make art and you could do it not only to kind of pay the bills, but you could do it kind of in tandem in connection with various social movements. And one of the things that I learned from him was that he would say, do you want to make, and let's see if I get this straight, I always kind of reverse it, do you want to make art for a living or do you want to make a life of art? Do you want it to pay your bills or is it something that is that much more? And to me, it's always been that much more for me. And so I guess in some ways I've been able to make the art I make and people see it and it's been exhibited and it's kind of, and I've worked with unions and I've worked with a variety of other organizations with my art, and I've never really had to sell out. I've never really had to make it or kind of change how I was envisioning my art. In terms of the visual style that Carlos's work took, I mean, working in relief prints and the like. I mean, you can see within not just my work, but I think there's a whole kind of generation of younger artists who are drawn to the relief printing style of the Taller de Gráfica Popular, the People's Print Workshop in kind of 1930s Mexico, which then inspired Carlos, which then inspired folks like myself, or there's another member of Just Seeds, Pete Yonke, who also studied with Carlos. He went to this art camp one summer, and Carlos was one of the mentors. So I think Carlos's influence has been not just in terms of his visual style and his way that he mixes kind of pop and politics, but the way that he does it in a way that doesn't remove his social commitments from the artwork.
Okay. And so, I mean, you know, really in looking at Carlos's stuff and looking at your stuff, and I mean, you see this big debate that's happening. And I mean, it's really happening particularly, I think, within, you know, or among Chicano artists, right. Because you have this, you know, sort of this generation of, you know, movement artists who are coming up, and all the stuff that they're doing is, you know, very much around protests, and it's about Aslan and about, you know, the freedom of the people. And then, you know, you have this next generation that come along and they say, you know what, I mean, it's not that we don't believe in that, but that's not what our art is about. And so, I mean, I think it's interesting because, I mean, from my perspective, you know, as a scholar of you know, Chicano literature and Chicano history, I mean, I would say that a Chicano identity is essentially oppositional. And that when it stops being oppositional, that you're not really Chicano anymore. And so, I mean, I would say also too that impacts art, whether people want it to or not. I mean, so, you know, how do you see this debate in the way that it's shaping up?
It's interesting because even during the movement, you would see, and I've been working on a book looking at the role of Aslan within Chicano art. And if you look back during the Movimiento, you see that even during this time, there was this debate happening. Should art be kind of used for the needs of the people, or should our art be in some ways autonomous? You mentioned it at the beginning, kind of this notion of art for art's sake, and although we it comes up again and again, and I know that, you know, some of us have kind of jokes about it because for certain sectors, right, there was this notion that art could be autonomous and that we should let it be so. But during the movement, especially folks like Malaquias Montoya were both making art that was politically committed, but also writing about it and saying that the artist needs to be kind of committed to these things. A handful of years ago, there was an exhibition curated, an exhibition at Denver. I think it was from Metro State College. And it was called Leaving Aslan. And the whole kind of precept of the exhibition was that we've somehow left Aslan behind.
It's interesting.
It's a very interesting concept. But in response to that, at a small school in Alamosa, Colorado, Adams State College, which if you know kind of northern New Mexico, southern Colorado history, I mean, that's kind of Alamosa is like kind of, you'll see a lot of like Nuevo Mexicanos going to school there. But in response, they had a show called Never Leaving Aslan, kind of directly responding that, well, you know, maybe the times have changed, maybe situations in the social environment has changed, but the reality is that this concept of Aslan can never be left behind because the realities of it are still there.
And I think that's really interesting that you would have an art exhibit called Leaving Aslan, because I mean it's obviously a place that I mean, for all intents and purposes, that we've never physically been to yet, you know, at least that we can say this is Aslan. You know, I think that in terms of being able to, you know, talk about it as a narrative of resistance, you know, so that you have this sort of ongoing idea, particularly, you know, after the Mexican-American War, that, you know, you have this new group of people who are displaced and that, you know, they're searching for a homeland. And obviously the United States is reluctantly agreed, you know, to accept them. And they have decided of their own accord not to return to Mexico, but to stay where they're at. So, I mean, that's interesting. I think it's also interesting in terms of how you would maybe frame it as like a post-nationalist, within a post-nationalist discussion, you know, and basically saying that, you know, because Aslan is obviously is a great symbol. It's a symbol of unity, but it's also a symbol of Chicano nationalist thought, and you know. So I mean, I don't know. What do you think about that?
Right. I mean, it's so complex, and for me, I think it was an intentional response, and the exhibition fits right into kind of this post-structuralist move. This notion, I mean, and you see it kind of within other communities of colors too. I mean, within kind of African American art histories and exhibitions and things, you'll see kind of what's been called post-Black African American art, right? And you'll even see kind of notions of post-Chicano art. But what do those really mean? They're kind of trying to kind of tie into the ambiguity of the 90s and 2000s, but in many ways, right? It gets back to kind of, without being overly intellectual, you know, this notion of post, what does it mean?
Too late. Yeah, well, whatever. Yeah.
But I mean, what does the post mean? I mean, can, you know, just as, you know, was Aslan really left? I mean, can you really leave Aslan?
Yeah.
Right. I know in some ways, I think the curator was trying to play with the fact that Aslan was the point of which migration to Tenochtitlan happened. Right. So I think there was some kind of playing with that. But I think it also kind of plays with the idea that the radical political activism, the revolutionary movements in some regards of the 1960s, of the movimiento, of the Chicano movement, of the Red Power movement, of the Black Power movement, that those are dead. And yeah. I think what we're seeing now, post-NAFTA, throughout the Bush regime, post-Bush, is that many of these kind of globalizing capitalist projects are very much still alive. And Stuart Hall, the great kind of father, if you will, we don't want to think of in those terms, but of cultural studies, often wrote about the power of capitalism to kind of circumscribe all things and bring it into its own project. And so all of these counter hegemonic and resistant movements become co-opted and incorporated in. And that's one of the things I think we see, is that the narratives of resistance become incorporated in, and then somehow the story is told that they've ended, right? And so we see kind of the post movements or the post movement era,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, because there's an assumption that once they're, well, like you said, circumscribed in, that they're no longer, it's no longer a narrative of resistance,
right?
That because it has become a part of this, of pop culture or whatever, that that it doesn't have the same meaning.
Right.
I don't know if that's necessarily always true. And also what I don't know, and what I think I'm actually reluctant to believe, is that the power that those narratives have disappears forever, you know, because I think that it has I think a lot to do with the way that that people want to understand them, you know. And so I mean, it may be harder at a certain point to sort of like reinvent or to like, you know, re-imbue those ideas. But yeah, I don't know. It's complex. Like you said, it's a big discussion.
And I think that's one of, at least for me, one of the powerful elements of Aslan and the concept of Aslan is that if we look back, and this is one of the things I'm interested in, if you look back over the last, You know, if you kind of go by the normal historical accounts that Aslan was re-evoked in 1969 by Alorista in Denver at the Chicano Youth Liberation Conference, Jack Forbes, the native historian, says that he was using it in the early 60s in his courses and in his thinking to talk about kind of indigenous Mexican America. But if we go back to 69 as that kind of point, we'll see throughout the last 40 years there's various Aslans, that different people are evoking it for different meanings or for different reasons, and that it has different meanings. But all of them, or most of them, are tied to a very emancipatory and radical political trajectory, right? And so if we think that it has any importance today, I think that's what it is. It's embedded with this very radical, anti-capitalist, pro-indigenous perspective. And I'm often reminded of a print, a silkscreen by Fabiana Rodriguez, who's a Chicana artist from the Bay Area, from Oakland. And I'm sure you've seen it. It's got an image of the soldadera standing there, and it says something, Iraq is Aslan, a warrior for her people, that Iraq is Aslan. But just as Malaquias Montoya in the 60s and 70s was drawing parallels between the experiences of Chicanos here in the States and of kind of the Vietnamese and the oppression and violence that were being enacted on both communities, kind of artists today, like Fabiana, are drawing parallels between what we're seeing kind of in the Middle East and particularly in Iraq with what still happens within kind of indigenous Mexican America.
So I just real quick, I also want to get kind of your opinion on this, is that, I mean, as you look at like the art that happened through the Chicano movement in the 60s and the 70s, I mean, a lot of that was poster based. It was popular art. It was created, you know, for the people, and it was done, I don't want to say it was done cheaply, but the way that it was produced, I mean, it was mass produced, and you know, it was spread around. How do you see that type of art, you know, coming out today? I mean, there's an explosion of images all around us on the internet and TV. I mean, on our telephones. I mean, we can't get away from the image, right? You know, and so I mean, does this take away from the power of that message, or does it add
right.
to it?
Right. I mean, I think what you have, and that you know, it's a good conversation, Todd. You have a very kind of two disparate kind of thoughts that come to mind. On the one hand, we live in a media saturated society, right? I mean, we're frequently inundated with Facebook, and you know, I myself have an iPhone, and I'm always checking the apps, and you know. The internet's always there, and you go anywhere and you're just kind of bombarded with visual images, always kind of always under the auspices of capitalism, right? So on the one hand, we're becoming this hyper visual society, or we, you know, in many ways maybe we have been for some time. So the grassroots visual practices of the movement, I think, are very much alive today in a variety of ways. You know, I mentioned Fabiana's work, and she works in posters. She does screen prints. She does digital offsets, or she does digital images. She does offset lithographs. There was a project that she did, or that she organized. I made a poster for, as well as three other artists, two Chicano and one Mexicano, Artemio Rodriguez, Melanie Cervantes, and Chuy Barraza. And they were very cheaply, inexpensively mass-produced objects to be used at an immigrant rights conference in Mexico City. So we're still seeing these kind of mass-produced objects being made. Or I don't want to say mass-produced because they're not, right? I mean, they're being produced kind of in multiples. People think about prints as multiple. But one of the changes I would say that we've seen is the incorporation of stencil. And if you go into any urban environment, you'll see stencil graffiti kind of all over the place. And so this has been incorporated into kind of this radical political agenda. You know, one of the projects that Josh McPhee, one of the other cats in Just Seeds, does is he does this project called Celebrate People's History. It's a poster series of dozens and dozens of posters, which are 11 by 17, produced in small offset lithograph runs of a few thousand, and then they're sold for a few bucks. And if you go to any city, you'll see these wheat pasted on the city. So while you're driving down the highway and seeing big billboards that are kind of being produced by corporations telling us to consume or to purchase or to kind of do certain things, there's also kind of a grassroots alternative to these, which we see kind of on a daily basis. And even if you drive through Lansing and East Lansing, you'll see some of this. It's graffiti, it's posters, it's handbills, it's all of these things. And so there's, you know, this dialogue going on, and you'll even see it with a variety of kind of activist-based websites and using tools like Facebook and social networking to organize. So on the one hand, I think we're being kind of saturated with media, but on the other hand, I think we've been able to shift it and change it and manipulate it in a way that some of the same things that have been happening since time immemorial are still kind of existing and being transformed in positive ways.
Okay, it's a really good conversation, Dylan. I'm really glad that you came tonight. We're gonna we just have a few minutes left, and so what I really was hoping that we could talk about was some of the work that you're doing with the Native community here, the Three Fires community here in Michigan, and how that's going. Some of the work that you're doing with the Anishinaabe language, and you know, tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So for a while now, about a year, I've been working directly with two friends, two Anishinaabe activists, Don Lyons and Oz Teeple, and we've created this project where we work directly with Anishinaabe Mohwin or Ojibwe language speakers here in mid-Michigan. And so we call this the Nkwejong Project, which means the place where the rivers meet, because Lansing is a place where the Red Cedar and the Grand River meet. And so for the last year or so, we've been getting together on a weekly or biweekly basis with these Ojibwe language speakers and beginning to just hang out, have conversations, both in the language and in English. And we created it because we created it as an oral history project. And we did it as an oral history project because one of the things about Lansing, which we often don't think about, is that it has one of the largest Anishinaabe Mohwin speaking populations of any urban community. For the past 40 plus years, and actually beginning in the late 50s, as I've learned through these conversations, Anishinaabe folks from Manitoulin Island began migrating down to Lansing, to Chicago, to urban areas in the Great Lake to work in the auto industry. And for a variety of reasons, including recruiting and kind of folks recruiting their kin to come live and come work in the auto industry, you have this huge community of Anishinaabe, particularly from Manitoulin Island, living here. And because Manitoulin's an island, because islands are isolated, the language has been preserved there more so than some of the reserve communities here in Michigan. And so because of that, in this group of elders we meet with, there's a core group of four, and one of them teaches the language at Saginaw Chippewa Tribal College, and another one is teaching the language at U of M. Also in Lansing, we have the elder who teaches the language at Michigan State. So in this community, we have, you know, some of the most fluent and active speakers. And it's all tied in many ways to industrial labor and the effects that that have. And so we've used this Nkwejong project to begin to kind of integrate with other things, some things that Oz and Don were doing beforehand, which they call Anishinaabe Traditional Knowledge Revival Pathways. And so Traditional Knowledge Revival Pathways, TKRP, is an organization in Australia, which is kind of using digital recording and digital documentation to begin to understand and begin to kind of document for community use language, traditional practices, ecological knowledge from the elders, and kind of tying together the technological interests of young generations with the very real knowledge of the land that the, you know, the old folks have. And so with our project, you know, a couple years ago, Don brought a delegation of TKRP, of Aboriginal Australians, to kind of go throughout the Great Lakes and have conversations. And so Nkwejong kind of begins these oral histories as a way to also engage in some of the organizing and the traditional knowledges in the community. And so we've begun a variety of different activities. This year we had hoped to do a urban sugar bush, the first annual urban sugar bush. But for those in mid-Michigan, we realized that for some reason it went from being winter to spring, going from like 30 degrees to 60 degrees.
It's global warming, dude.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's a little frightening, but you know, we went basically from 30 to 60. And so, you know, I mean, one of the things about sugaring is it's got to be kind of below freezing at night and warm during the day, and it basically mess things up for that. But there's a variety of other projects that are going on, and hopefully we'll be kind of engaging with other folks. We put a proposal in for the U.S. Social Forum. I also put a proposal for my art in for the U.S. Social Forum. So I think a lot of these activities, you know, are going to be coalescing here in mid-Michigan and having conversations with folks in Detroit kind of from throughout the U.S. and from throughout the world.
Cool. Okay, well, I mean, that's pretty much our time. If you're interested in taking a look at some of Dylan's artwork, you can catch him at his website at Dylan, D-Y-L-A-N, Miner, M-I-N-E-R, that's all spelled with one word, .com, DylanMiner.com. We want to thank Dylan for being here with us again. My name is Ernesto Todd Morales, and this has been another podcast of the Chicano Development Center.
Radio Free Aslan is co-produced by Roberto Reyes, Felix Medina, and Luis Moreno. It is recorded and edited by Luis Moreno. This monthly podcast is brought to you by the Chicano Development Center, a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to education and political empowerment through grassroots coalition building. We believe in the indigenous sovereignty of the Chicano people in the United States, and that true social and political change begins with the people. Our style of low-intensity organizing endeavors to build intentional communities within greater communities. The motivating force behind low-intensity organizing is to constantly challenge the status quo as to the treatment and economic status, not only of Chicanos and other indigenous people, but of all oppressed people. At the Chicano Development Center, we believe that resistance begins with education, organization, and preparation. We believe that raza must take action on a regular basis, not just in times of crisis.
As J's, what we love the best.